Character and Presentation. To study the ways and means through which one may develop a pleasing personality, I will begin with the first essential, which is character. For no one can have a pleasing personality without the foundation of a sound, positive character. Through the principle of telepathy, you telegraph the nature of your character to those with whom you come in contact, which is also why you may have had an intuitive feeling that the person you had just met, but about whom you did not know very much, was not trustworthy. You may wear the best and latest clothes and conduct yourself in a most pleasing manner outwardly, but if there is greed and envy and hatred and jealousy and selfishness in your heart, you will never attract anyone except those who are the same. Like attracts like, and you may be sure, therefore, that those who are attracted to you are those whose inward natures parallel your own. You may present an artificial smile, and you may practice handshaking so that you can imitate perfectly the handshake of the person who is adept at this art. But if these outward manifestations of a pleasing personality lack that vital factor called earnestness of purpose, they will turn people away rather than attract them to you. How, then, does one build character? The first step in character building is rigid self-discipline. In both the second and eighth lessons of this course, you will find the formula through which you may shape your character after any pattern that you choose. But I repeat it here, as it is based on a principle that deserves much repetition. First, think of people whose characters are made up of the qualities you wish to build into your own character, and then proceed in the manner described in Lesson 2, Volume 1, to take on these qualities through the aid of auto-suggestion. Create in your imagination a council table and gather your characters around it each night, first having written out a clear, concise statement of the particular qualities that you wish to assume from each. Then, proceed to affirm or suggest to yourself, aloud, that you are developing the desired qualities in yourself. As you do this, close your eyes and see, in your imagination, the figure seated around your imaginary table, in the manner described in Lesson 2. Second, through the principles described in Lesson 8, Volume 2, on self-control, focus your thoughts and keep your mind energized with thoughts of a positive nature. Let the dominating thought of your mind be a picture of the person that you intend to be, the person that you are deliberately building through this process. At least a dozen times a day, when you have a few minutes to yourself, shut your eyes and direct your thoughts to the figures that you have selected to sit at your imaginary council table. Then feel, with a faith that knows no limitation, that you are actually growing to resemble in character those figures of your choice. Third, find at least one person each day, and more if possible, in whom you see some good quality that is worthy of praise, and praise them for it. Remember, however, that this praise must not be in the nature of cheap, insincere flattery. It must be genuine. Speak your words of praise with such earnestness that they will impress those to whom you speak. Then watch what happens. You will have rendered those whom you praised a decided benefit of great value to them, and you will have gone just one more step in the direction of developing the habit of looking for and finding the good qualities in others. I cannot overemphasize the far-reaching effects of this habit of praising, openly and enthusiastically, the good qualities in others, for this habit will soon reward you with a feeling of self-respect and manifestation of gratitude from others that will modify your entire personality. Here, again, the law of attraction enters, and those whom you praise will see in you the qualities that you see in them. Your success in the application of this formula will be in exact proportion to your faith in its soundness. I do not merely believe that it is sound. I know that it is, and the reason I know is that I have used it successfully, and I have also taught others how to use it successfully. Therefore, I have a right to promise you that you can use it with equal success. Furthermore, you can, with the aid of this formula, develop a pleasing personality so quickly that it will surprise all who know you. The development of such a personality is entirely within your own control, which gives you a tremendous advantage, and at the same time places the responsibility on you if you fail or neglect to exercise your privilege. I would like to point out the reason for speaking aloud. The affirmation that you are developing the qualities that you have selected as the materials out of which to develop a pleasing personality. This procedure has two desirable effects. First, it sets into motion the vibration through which the thought behind your words reaches and embeds itself in your subconscious mind. There, it takes root and grows until it becomes a great moving force in your outward physical activities leading to the transformation of the thought into reality. Second, it helps you develop the ability to speak with force and conviction, which can lead to great ability as a public speaker. No matter what your calling in life may be, you should be able to stand on your feet and speak convincingly. Put feeling and emotion into your words as you speak, and develop a deep, rich tone of voice. If your voice is inclined to be high-pitched, tone it down until it is soft and pleasing. You can never express an attractive personality to best advantage through a harsh or shrill voice. You must cultivate your voice until it becomes rhythmical and pleasing to the ear. Remember that speech is the chief method of expressing your personality, and for this reason, it is to your advantage to cultivate a style that is both forceful and pleasing. I do not recall a single outstanding pleasing personality that was not made up of, in part, of an ability to speak with force and conviction. Study the outstanding figures of the past in politics and statesmanship, and observe that the most successful ones were those who were noted for their ability to speak with force and conviction. Study the prominent men and women of today, wherever you find them, and observe the significant fact that the more prominent they are, the more efficient they are in speaking forcefully. In the field of business, industry, and finance, it seems significant also that the most prominent leaders are men and women who are able public speakers. In fact, no one may hope to become a prominent leader in any noteworthy undertaking without developing the ability to speak with forcefulness that carries conviction. While the salesperson may never deliver a public address, they will profit nonetheless if they develop the ability to do so, because this ability increases his or her power to speak convincingly in ordinary conversation. Editor's comment. To hear how your voice sounds to others, record yourself in conversation. You will likely be surprised how different it sounds when you hear the recording played back. If you don't like what you hear, and if you can be objective, study the tape to see where you could make improvements. Note the tone, the pitch, and the rhythm of your speech pattern. If you continue to work with the tape recorder and are still not pleased with the changes you can affect on your own, you might consider buying one of the audio programs available, or perhaps consulting a voice coach. As important as the sound of your voice, if not more important, are the words you use, and this is another way by which people will judge you. Unless you are certain of the exact meaning of a word, don't use it. Opt instead for one that is more familiar to you. There are many books that point out some of the common mistakes people make in an attempt to sound more knowledgeable, and these books can be invaluable. One of the best known is The Elements of Style by William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White, which offers information for both the spoken and written word. There are also audio courses that not only teach new vocabulary, but also allow you to hear the words used in context while hearing the correct pronunciation. You will find many of these audio programs in the audiobook section of most large bookstores. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Let us now summarize the 7 chief factors that enter into the development of a pleasing personality. Number 1. Form the habit of interesting yourself in other people, and make it your business to find their good qualities and speak of them in terms of praise. Number 2. Develop the ability to speak with force and conviction, both in your ordinary conversational tones and before public gatherings where you must use more volume. Number 3. Dress in a style that is becoming to you and appropriate to the work in which you are engaged. Number 4. Develop a positive character through the aid of the formula outlined in this lesson. Number 5. Learn how to shake hands so that you express warmth and enthusiasm through this form of greeting. Number 6. Attract other people to you by first attracting yourself to them. Number 7. Remember that your only limitation, within reason, is the one that you set up in your own mind. These 7 points cover the most important factors, although such a personality will obviously not develop of its own accord. It will develop, however, if you submit yourself to the discipline herein described, with the firm determination to transform yourself into the person that you would like to be. I stress the 2nd and the 4th as being the most important. If you will cultivate those finer thoughts, feelings, and actions out of which a positive character is built, and then learn to express yourself with force and conviction, you will have developed a pleasing personality, for it will be seen that out of this will come the other qualities here outlined. There is a great power of attraction in the person who has a positive character, and this power expresses itself in unseen as well as visible ways. The moment you come within speaking distance of such a person, even though not a word is spoken, the influence of the unseen power within makes itself felt. Every shady transaction in which you engage, every negative thought that you think, and every destructive act destroys something within your character. Emerson wrote, "There is full confession in the glances of our eyes, in our smiles, in salutations, in the grasp of the hands. His sin bedaubs him, mars all his good impression. Men know not why they do not trust him, but they do not trust him. His vice glasses his eye, demeans his cheek, pinches the nose, sets the mark of beast on the back of the head, and writes, 'O fool, fool,' on the forehead of a king." Pay close attention to the first of the seven factors in developing a pleasing personality. All through this lesson, I have gone into lengthy detail to show the material advantages of being agreeable to other people. The biggest advantage of all, however, lies not in the possibility of monetary or material gain, but in the enhancing effect that it has on the character of all who practice it. Acquire the habit of making yourself agreeable, and you profit both materially and emotionally, for you will never be as happy in any other way as you will be when you know that you are making others happy. Get the chip off your shoulder and stop challenging people to engage you in useless arguments. Remove the dark glasses through which you see what you believe to be the negative side of life, and behold the shining sunlight of friendliness instead. Throw away your hammer and quit knocking, for surely you must know that the big prizes of life go to the builders and not to the destroyers. The man who builds a house is an artist. The man who tears it down is a junk man. If you are a person with a grievance, the world will listen to your caustic rantings only if it does not see you coming. But if you are a person with a message of friendliness and optimism, it will listen because it wishes to do so. No person with a grievance can also be a person with an attractive personality. The art of being agreeable, just that one simple trait, is the very foundation of all successful salesmanship. I drive my automobile 5 miles to the outskirts of the city to purchase gasoline, which I could get within 2 blocks of my own garage, because the man who runs the filling station is an artist. He makes it his business to be agreeable. I go there not because he has cheaper gasoline, but because I enjoy the vitalizing effect of his pleasing personality. I purchased my shoes at the Regal Shoe Store at 50th Street and Broadway in New York, not because I cannot find other good shoes at the same price, but because Mr. Cobb, the manager of that particular Regal store, has a pleasing personality. While he is fitting me with shoes, he makes it his business to talk with me about subjects that he knows to be close to my heart. I do my banking at the Harriman National Bank at 44th Street and 5th Avenue, not because there are not scores of other good banks much nearer my place of business, but because the tellers, the cashiers, the lobby detective, Mr. Harriman, and all the others with whom I come in contact make it their business to be agreeable. My account is small, but they receive me as though it were large. I greatly admire John D. Rockefeller, Jr., not because he is the son of one of the world's richest men, but because he, too, has acquired the art of being agreeable. In the little city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, lives M.T. Garvin, a very successful merchant whom I would travel hundreds of miles to visit because he makes it his business to be agreeable. I have no doubt that his material success is closely related to this noble art that he has acquired. I have in my vest pocket a Parker fountain pen, and my wife and children have pens of the same brand, not because there are not other good fountain pens, but because I admire George S. Parker for his habit of being agreeable. My wife subscribes to the Ladies' Home Journal, not because there are not other good magazines of a similar nature, but because we became attracted to the journal several years ago while Edward Bach was its editor, and he, too, had acquired the art of being agreeable. O ye struggling pilgrims who are searching for the rainbow's end, ye drawers of water and hewers of wood, tarry for a moment by the wayside, and learn a lesson from the successful men and women who have succeeded because they acquired the art of being agreeable. You can win for a time through ruthlessness and stealth. You can acquire more worldly goods than you will need, by sheer force and shrewd strategy, without taking the time or going to the trouble of being agreeable. But, sooner or later, you will come to that point in life when you feel the pangs of remorse and the emptiness of your well-filled purse. I never think of power and position and wealth that was attained by force without feeling very deeply the sentiment expressed by a man whose name I dare not mention as he stood at the tomb of Napoleon Bonaparte. Editor's Commentary. The editors have learned that the following piece was written by Robert Greene Ingersoll, who in the late 1800s was America's best-known orator, particularly on behalf of Republican causes and candidates. Ingersoll was also friends with and admired by Napoleon Hill's mentor, Andrew Carnegie. Resuming now with Napoleon Hill quoting Robert Greene Ingersoll. A little while ago, I stood by the grave of the old Napoleon, a magnificent tomb of gilt and gold, fit almost for a deity dead, and gazed upon the sarcophagus of rare and nameless marble, where rest at last the ashes of that restless man. I leaned over the balustrade and thought about the career of the greatest soldier of the modern world. I saw him at Toulon. I saw him walking upon the banks of the Seine, contemplating suicide. I saw him putting down the mob in the streets of Paris. I saw him at the head of the army in Italy. I saw him crossing the bridge at Lodi with the tricolor in his hand. I saw him in Egypt, in the shadows of the pyramids. I saw him conquer the Alps and mingle the eagles of France with the eagles of the crags. I saw him at Marengo, at Ulm, and at Austerlitz. I saw him in Russia when the infantry of the snow and the cavalry of the wild blast scattered his legions like winter's withered leaves. I saw him at Leipzig in defeat and disaster, driven by a million bayonets back upon Paris, clutched like a wild beast, banished to Elba. I saw him escape and retake an empire by the force of his genius. I saw him upon the frightful field of Waterloo, where chance and fate combined to wreck the fortunes of their former king. And I saw him at St. Helena, with his hands crossed behind him, gazing out upon the sad and solemn sea. I thought of the widows and orphans he had made, of the tears that had been shed for his glory, and of the only woman who ever loved him, pushed from his heart by the cold hand of ambition. And I said I would rather have been a French peasant and worn wooden shoes. I would rather have lived in a hut with a vine growing over the door, and the grapes growing purple in the amorous kisses of the autumn sun. I would rather have been that poor peasant, with my wife by my side, knitting as the day died out of the sky, with my children upon my knees and their arms about me. I would rather have been this man and gone down to the tongueless silence of the dreamless dust than to have been that imperial personation of force and murder known as Napoleon the Great. I leave with you, as a fitting climax for this lesson, the thought of this deathless dissertation on a man who lived by the sword of force and died an ignominious death, an outcast in the eyes of his fellow men, a sore to the memory of civilization, a failure because he did not acquire the art of being agreeable. He could not, or would not, subordinate self for the good of his followers. Lesson 11. Accurate thinking. You can do it if you believe you can. This is the most important, the most interesting, and the most difficult to present lesson of this entire course on the law of success. It is important because it deals with a principle that runs through the entire course. It is interesting for the same reason. It is difficult to present because it will carry the average student far beyond the boundary line of his or her common experiences and into a realm of thought in which they are unaccustomed to being. Unless you study this lesson with an open mind, you will miss the very keystone to the arch of this course, and without this stone, you can never complete your temple of success. This lesson will bring you a concept of thought that may carry you far beyond the level you have reached through your previous evolutionary processes, and for this reason, you should not be disappointed if, at first, you do not fully understand it. Most of us disbelieve that which we cannot understand, and it is with my knowledge of this human tendency that I caution you against closing your mind if you do not at first grasp everything that is in this lesson. For thousands of years, men made ships of wood and of nothing else. They used wood because they believed it was the only substance that would float. But that was because they had not yet advanced far enough in their thinking process to understand the truth that steel will float and that it is far superior to wood for the building of ships. They did not know that anything could float that was lighter than the amount of water it displaced, and until they learned of this great truth, they went on making ships of wood. Until early in this century, most people thought that only birds could fly. Now we know that humans can not only equal the flying of the birds, but we can exceed it. We did not know until quite recently that the air is more alive and more sensitive than anything that is on the earth. We did not know that the spoken word would travel with the speed of lightning without the aid of wires. How could we know this when our minds had not been sufficiently unfolded to enable them to grasp it? The purpose of this lesson is to aid you in unfolding and expanding your mind so that you will be able to think with accuracy. This will open to you a door that leads to all the power you will need in completing your temple of success. All through the preceding lessons of this course, we have dealt with principles that anyone could easily grasp and apply, and they have been presented so as to lead to success as measured by material wealth. I was aware that the majority of students would be disappointed if I showed them a roadway to success that leads other than through the doorways of business, finance, and industry. To most people, the word success and the word money are synonymous. They want success that is spelled with dollar signs. Very well, let those who are satisfied with this standard of success have it. But there are some who will want to go higher up the ladder in search of success that is measured other than in material standards, and it is for their benefit in particular that this and the subsequent lessons of this course are intended. Deductive reasoning. Accurate thinking involves two fundamentals. First, to think accurately, you must separate facts from mere information. There is much information available to you that is not based on facts. Second, you must separate facts into two classes, the important and the unimportant, or the relevant and the irrelevant. All facts that you can use in the attainment of your definite chief aim are important and relevant, and those you cannot use are unimportant and irrelevant. It is mainly the neglect of some to make this distinction that so widely separates those people who appear to have equal ability and those who have had equal opportunity. Within your own circle of acquaintances, you can likely point to one or more persons who have had no greater opportunity than you and who have no more ability than you, but who are achieving far greater success. And you wonder why. The answer is that they have acquired the habit of combining and using the important facts that affect their line of work. Far from working harder than you, they are perhaps working less and with greater ease. By separating the important facts from the unimportant, they have provided themselves with the sort of fulcrum and lever with which they can move, with their little fingers, loads that you cannot budge with the entire weight of your body. So that you may understand the importance of distinguishing between facts and mere information, study the type of person who is guided entirely by what they hear, the type who is influenced by gossip, who accepts without analysis all that they read or hear in the news, and who judges others by what their enemies, competitors, and contemporaries say about them. Think of your circle of acquaintances and pick out one of this type as an example to keep in mind while we're on this subject. Observe that this person usually begins conversations with phrases such as, "I see by the papers," or "they say." The accurate thinker knows that the newspapers are not always accurate in their reports, and that what they say usually carries more falsehood than truth. In searching for facts, it is often necessary to gather them through the knowledge and experience of others. It then becomes necessary to carefully examine both the evidence submitted and the person from whom the evidence comes. When the evidence is such that it affects the interest of the witness who is giving it, scrutinize it all the more carefully. Witnesses who have an interest in the evidence often yield to the temptation to color and misuse it to protect that interest. If one person slanders another, those remarks should be accepted with some caution, for it is a common human tendency for people to find nothing but evil in those they do not like. Anyone who has reached the degree of accurate thinking that enables them to speak of their enemy without exaggerating that person's faults and minimizing their virtues is the exception and not the rule. Before you can become an accurate thinker, you must understand and make allowance for the fact that the moment a man or a woman begins to assume leadership in any walk of life, the slanderers begin to circulate rumors and innuendos reflecting on his or her character. No matter how fine one's character or what service they may be rendering to the world, no one can escape the notice of those misguided people who delight in destroying instead of building. The moment anyone begins to make themselves felt in the field of industry or business, this chorus becomes active. If someone makes a better mousetrap than their neighbor, the world will make a beaten path to their door, And in the gang that will trail along will be those who come not to commend, but to condemn and to destroy that person's reputation. As an accurate thinker, it is both your privilege and your duty to avail yourself of facts, even though you must go out of your way to get them. If you permit yourself to be swayed by all manner of information that comes to your attention, you will never become an accurate thinker. And if you do not think accurately, you cannot be sure of attaining your definite chief aim in life. Many have gone down to defeat because, due to their prejudice and hatred, they underestimated the virtues of their enemies or competitors. The eyes of the accurate thinker see facts, not the delusions of prejudice, hate, and envy. As an accurate thinker, you must be fair enough, with yourself at least, to look for virtues as well as faults in other people. I do not believe that I can afford to deceive others. I know I cannot afford to deceive myself. This must be the motto of the accurate thinker. From the editors. To the modern listener, it may seem that at the beginning of this section, Napoleon Hill belabors unnecessarily his point about needing factual information upon which to base opinions and make decisions. Surely that is self-evident to anyone seeking advice on how to achieve success. Understanding the context in which Hill wrote the advice will explain why he felt it was necessary to place so much emphasis on the point. Following that are some facts that will make it clear why his point is still just as valid today. In 1928, most Americans got their information from newspapers. Every city of any size had a half dozen or more dailies, publishing morning editions, home editions, late editions, and hawking extras on the street corners when there was breaking news. These were the days of the great newspaper wars, scandal sheets, yellow journalism, and political cronyism. It was a time when newspapers were often blatantly biased, and publishers thought nothing of slanting stories to fit their personal prejudices and political agendas. Though science and medicine had made tremendous advances in the first part of the century, it would still be a generation or two before that knowledge would become part of the general education of the average American. Newspapers were still the main source of information about such things, and the back pages were filled with advertisements for pseudoscientific contraptions that promised to cure diseases by harnessing the power of magnetism or the miraculous effects of radio waves. Quack doctors touted patent medicines and pills that were often mostly opium or cocaine that dulled the senses but did little to cure anything. When viewed in that context, it is little wonder that Napoleon Hill felt it was important to caution his readers about the source of their information. But what significance does his advice have today? America has advanced since then through the information age, the communication age, and the internet age. News is delivered to us as it happens from anywhere on earth, and even children have instant access to information databanks that stagger the imagination. The world has indeed changed, but as the editors of this edition have often pointed out, the times may be different, but the basic principles Hill writes about remain just that, basic principles. Though journalistic standards have improved tremendously, and it is rare to find an executive of a reputable news organization who blatantly manipulates the news, it would be a mistake to believe that what you hear, see, or read is fact. It only means that today, bias is less obvious, and we must be even more astute when searching for the facts necessary for accurate thinking. By the end of the 20th century, the term spin doctor came into common usage. It was used to describe political or government officials or PR professionals whose job was to take the news and spin it in the way that served a particular purpose and advanced his or her political agenda. Another commonly heard term was the liberal media, used often in reference to television news and the perception that there was a left-leaning bias among the major networks. However, in radio broadcasting at that same time, the majority of talk shows featured highly opinionated hosts whose popularity was based on their controversial right-wing views. The two most popular cable television news networks were evenly divided, with CNN usually identified as liberal and the Fox News Channel usually regarded as conservative. Clearly, today what you believe to be fact or truth still depends greatly on how and where you get your information. As to the enormous amount of facts and information made easily accessible to anyone today, in researching material for this section, the editors did an internet search to find the facts about the discovery of penicillin. One version of the facts said that in 1928, Scottish researcher Alexander Fleming went on vacation leaving a lab dish growing bacteria. During his absence, it became contaminated with a Penicillium mold spore. On his return, he noticed that the mold had stopped the growth of the germs. This version also says that Fleming did nothing further to develop penicillin, but others did. Another version is that Fleming was such a hard-working bacteriologist that he wouldn't even go out for lunch. One day, at a time when he was suffering from boils, he ate a forgotten sandwich that had turned green with mold. When it seemed that his boils had been cured, he proceeded to research the mold. Still another version is that amidst the mess in Fleming's lab were several petri dishes in which he had intentionally been growing bacteria. As he was cleaning up and about to throw these out, he noticed in one that all around the mold the staph bacteria had been killed. He researched it further, and the following year published a report on the potential uses of penicillin. His work was eventually taken over by a team of chemists and mold specialists, several of whom moved or died. Then, in 1935, a professor and researchers at Oxford became interested, took the study further, and in 1945, Alexander Fleming, Howard Florey, the professor, and Ernst Chain, the researcher, shared the Nobel Prize for the discovery of penicillin. It is stunning that there can be such inconsistency in the facts about something as significant as the discovery of penicillin. For an even more revealing picture of how widespread the belief is in some well-known facts that may not be facts at all, the editor suggests that you check out the many websites and books available on the subject of urban legends, as well as the book Why People Believe Weird Things by Michael Shermer, who is also publisher of Skeptic Magazine and director of the Skeptic Society. In doing so, you may find challenges to some of your own beliefs that you've based on what you assume to be well-known facts. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. In the realm of legal procedure, there is a principle called the law of evidence, and the object of this law is to get at the facts. Any judge can proceed with justice to all concerned if they have the facts upon which to base their judgment. But they may play havoc with innocent people if they circumvent the law of evidence and reach a conclusion or judgment that is based on hearsay information. The specific rules of evidence vary according to the subject and circumstances with which they are used. But you will not go far wrong if you follow this rule. If you do not have hard facts to work from, form your judgment on the part of the evidence before you that furthers your own interests without working any hardship on others and is based on facts. The phrase, without working any hardship on others, is a crucial and important point in this lesson. Many people mistake, knowingly or otherwise, expediency for fact, doing something, or refraining from doing it, for the sole reason that their action furthers their own interests, without consideration as to whether it interferes with the rights of others. It is amazing to the more advanced student of accurate thinking how many people there are who are honest when it is profitable to them, but find innumerable facts to justify themselves in following a dishonest course when that course seems to be more profitable or advantageous. The accurate thinker deals with facts, regardless of how they affect his or her own interests, for they know that ultimately this policy will bring them out on top, in full possession of the object of their definite chief aim in life. They understand the soundness of the philosophy that Croesus had in mind when he said, "There is a wheel on which the affairs of men revolve, and its mechanism is such that it prevents any man from being always fortunate." The accurate thinker adopts a standard by which they guide themselves, and they follow that standard at all times. That standard is observed as faithfully when it brings temporary disadvantage as it is when it brings outstanding advantage. Using accurate thinking, they know that by the law of averages, they will more than regain at some future time that which is lost when the results of applying the standard is to their own temporary detriment. You must understand that it requires the staunchest and most unshakable character to become an accurate thinker, for there can be a certain amount of temporary penalty attached to accurate thinking, but the compensating reward is so overwhelmingly greater that you will gladly pay this penalty. From the editors. Napoleon Hill was able to refine his philosophy of personal achievement and write The Law of Success because Andrew Carnegie introduced him to the leaders of business and industry in such a way that they were prepared to share with him the secrets of their success. But he also wrote from his personal experience. As the following story demonstrates, at an early age, Napoleon Hill proved that he himself was a person of unshakable character. As told by author Michael Rhett in his biography of Hill, A Lifetime of Riches, in 1902, after Hill had been promoted to chief clerk at one of Rufus Ayers' coal mines, the manager of the mine and his brother, who was cashier of a bank owned by Ayers, had gone on a drinking spree. At one of their later stops at a hotel, the brother dropped a loaded revolver he was carrying, and it discharged, killing a bellboy. Hill heard the news almost immediately and went to the hotel. He learned that the brother had left the bank the previous day and hadn't returned. Rushing to the bank, Hill found the vaults open and money scattered everywhere. He then wired the news to Ayers, who told him to count the money and charge Ayers' own account for any shortage. He counted it, found that no money was missing, and informed Ayers. Impressed by Hill's honesty, Ayers instantly promoted him to replace the manager, making this 19-year-old the youngest manager of a mine and in charge of 350 men. Hill's honesty received widespread publicity, which also served him well in his next ventures, but it's believed that he never spoke publicly of the moral dilemma he'd found himself in. He wrote of it in his memoirs only to point out the virtues of honesty, and while he likely wouldn't have known the term in 1902, it was also an excellent example of accurate thinking. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. With the supposition that the foregoing was sufficient to impress upon your mind the importance of searching for facts until you are reasonably sure that you have found them, we will now look at organizing, classifying, and using these facts. Consider again your own circle of acquaintances and find someone who appears to accomplish more with less effort than do any of their associates. Study this person, and you observe that he or she is a strategist, in that they learned how to arrange facts so as to bring to their aid the law of increasing returns, which was described in Lesson 9. The person who knows they are working with facts goes about their task with a feeling of self-confidence that enables them to refrain from procrastinating, hesitating, or waiting to make sure of their ground. They know in advance what the outcome of their efforts will be. Therefore, they move more rapidly and accomplish more than does the person who must feel their way because they are not sure they are working with facts. The person who has learned of the advantages of searching for facts as the foundation of their thinking has gone a very long way toward the development of accurate thinking. But the person who has learned how to separate facts into the important and the unimportant has gone still further. Inasmuch as this is an age in which money is looked upon as being the most concrete proof of success, let us look again at a man who has accumulated almost as much of it as has any other man in the history of the world, John D. Rockefeller. Mr. Rockefeller has one quality that stands out, like a shining star, above all of his other qualities. It is his habit of dealing only with the relevant facts pertaining to his life work. As a very young man, and a very poor man at that, Mr. Rockefeller adopted, as his definite chief aim, the accumulation of great wealth. It is not my purpose, nor is it of any particular advantage, to look into Mr. Rockefeller's method of accumulating his fortune, other than to observe that most of his pronounced quality was that of insisting on facts as the basis of his business philosophy. There are some who say that Mr. Rockefeller was not always fair with his competitors. That may or may not be true. As accurate thinkers, we will leave the point undisturbed. But no one, not even his competitors, ever accused Mr. Rockefeller of forming snap judgments or of underestimating the strength of his competitors. He not only recognized facts that affected his business, wherever and whenever he found them, but he also made it his business to search for them until he was sure he had found them. Thomas A. Edison is another example of a man who has attained greatness through the organization, classification, and use of relevant facts. Mr. Edison works with natural laws as his chief aids. Therefore, he must be sure of his facts before he can harness those laws. Every time you switch on an electric light, remember that it was Mr. Edison's capacity for organizing relevant facts that made this possible. In the field of science, relevant facts are the tools with which men and women work. Mere information, or hearsay evidence, is of no value to Mr. Edison. Yet, he might have wasted his life working with it, as millions of other people are doing. Hearsay evidence could never have produced the incandescent electric light, the phonograph, or the moving picture, and if it had, the phenomenon would have been an accident. In this lesson, we are trying to prepare the student to avoid accidents. The question now arises as to what constitutes an important and relevant fact. The answer depends entirely on what constitutes your definite chief aim in life. For an important and relevant fact is any fact that you can use without interfering with the rights of others and the attainment of that purpose. All other facts, as far as you are concerned, are superfluous and of minor importance at most. You can, however, work just as hard in organizing, classifying, and using unimportant and irrelevant facts as you can in dealing with their opposites, but you will not accomplish as much. Creative thought and infinite intelligence. Up to this point, we have been discussing only one factor of accurate thinking, that which is based on deductive reasoning. Some of the students of this course may now have to think along lines that are not familiar to them, for we have come to the discussion of thought that does much more than gather, organize, and combine facts. Let us call this creative thought. So that you can understand why it is called creative thought, it is necessary to briefly study the process of evolution through which the thinking man has been created. Thinking man has been a long time on the road of evolution and has traveled a very long way. In the words of Judge T. Troward in Bible Mystery and Bible Meaning, perfected man is the apex of the evolutionary pyramid, and this by a necessary sequence. Let us trace the five evolutionary steps through which we believe life has evolved, beginning with the very lowest. Number 1. Mineral period. Here we find life in its lowest form, lying motionless and inert, a mass of mineral substances with no power to move. Number 2. Vegetable period. Here life is in a more active form, with intelligence sufficient to gather food, grow, and reproduce, but still unable to move from its fixed moorings. Number 3. Animal period. Here we find life in a still higher and more intelligent form, and with the ability to move from place to place. Number 4. Human or thinking man period. Here we find life in its highest known form, the highest because man can think, and because thought is the highest known form of organized energy. In the realm of thought, man knows no limitations. He can gather facts and assemble them in new and varying combinations. He can create hypotheses and translate them into physical reality through thought. He can reason both inductively and deductively. Number 5. Spiritual. On this plane, the lower forms of life described in the previous four periods converge and become infinitude in nature. At this point, thinking man has unfolded, expanded, and grown until he has projected his thinking ability into infinite intelligence. As yet, thinking man is but an infant in this fifth period, for he has not learned how to make use of this infinite intelligence called spirit. Moreover, with a few rare exceptions, man has not yet recognized thought as the connecting link that gives him access to the power of infinite intelligence. These exceptions have been such men as Moses, Solomon, Christ, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Confucius, and a comparatively small number of others. Since their time, we have had many who partly uncovered this great truth, yet the truth itself is as available now as it was then. To make use of creative thought, one must work largely on faith, which is the chief reason why more of us do not indulge in this sort of thought. The most ignorant of us can think in terms of deductive reasoning in connection with issues of a purely physical and material nature, but to go a step higher and think in terms of infinite intelligence is another matter. The average person is totally lost the moment they get beyond that which they can comprehend with the aid of their five physical senses of seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, and tasting. Infinite intelligence works through none of these agencies, and we cannot invoke its aid through any of them. The only way to use the power of infinite intelligence is through creative thought. To make clear the exact manner in which this is done, I will refer to some of the preceding lessons of this course through which you have been prepared to understand the meaning of creative thought. In the second lesson, Volume 1, and to some extent in practically every subsequent lesson up to this one, you have observed the use of the term autosuggestion, suggestion that you make to yourself. We now come back to that term because autosuggestion is the way in which you may register in your subconscious mind a description or plan of what you wish to create or acquire in physical form. It is a process you can easily learn to use. The subconscious mind is the intermediary between the conscious thinking mind and the infinite intelligence. and you can invoke the aid of infinite intelligence only through the medium of the subconscious mind, by giving it clear instructions as to what you want. Here, you become familiar with the psychological reason for a definite chief aim. If you have not already seen the importance of creating a definite chief aim as the object of your life work, you will undoubtedly do so before this lesson has been mastered. Knowing from my own experience how little I understood about such terms as subconscious mind, auto-suggestion, and creative thought, throughout this course, I have described these terms through every conceivable simile and illustration, with the object of making their meaning and the method of their application so clear that no student of this course can possibly fail to understand. This accounts for the repetition of terms, and at the same time serves as an apology to those who have already advanced far enough to grasp the meaning of much that the beginner will not understand at first. An outstanding characteristic of the subconscious mind is that it records the suggestions that you send it through auto-suggestion, and it invokes the aid of infinite intelligence in translating these suggestions into their natural physical form. It is important that you understand this last sentence, for if you fail to understand it, you are likely to also fail to understand the importance of the very foundation upon which this entire course is built, the principle of infinite intelligence, which may be reached and used at will through the aid of the law of the mastermind described in Lesson 1, Volume 1. Study carefully, thoughtfully, and with meditation the entire preceding paragraph. An outstanding characteristic of the subconscious mind is that it accepts and acts upon all suggestions that reach it, whether they are constructive or destructive, and whether they come from the outside or from your own conscious mind. You can see, therefore, how essential it is for you to observe the law of evidence and to carefully follow the principles laid down at the beginning of this lesson in your selection of what you will pass on to your subconscious mind through auto-suggestion. You can see why you must search diligently for facts, and why you cannot afford to lend a receptive ear to the slanderer and to the scandalmonger, for to do so would be poisonous to the subconscious mind and ruinous to creative thought. The subconscious mind may be likened to the sensitive plate of a camera, on which the picture of any object placed before the camera will be recorded. The plate does not choose the sort of picture to be recorded on it. It records anything that reaches it through the lens. The conscious mind may be likened to the shutter, which shuts off the light to the sensitized plate, permitting nothing to reach the plate, for record, except that which the operator wishes to reach it. The lens of the camera may then be likened to auto-suggestion, for the lens is the medium that carries to the sensitized plate of the camera the image of the object to be registered. Infinite intelligence, by this example, may be likened to the person who develops the sensitized plate after a picture has been recorded on it, thus bringing the picture into physical reality. Editor's comment. The concept of what Hill refers to here as the plate is the same concept as roll film, which was invented in the late 1800s by George Eastman, founder of Kodak Eastman, and used then primarily by the amateur photographer. But perhaps Hill was more familiar with professional photography studios where plates were used. In the foreword by George M. C. Fisher, former chairman and CEO of the Eastman Kodak Company, to the book George Eastman, A Biography, by Elizabeth Breyer, the man whom Fisher describes is an excellent example of all that Hill espouses. Like Alexander Graham Bell, Eastman tinkered his way to a universally welcome invention. Like Henry Ford, he put his name on his company. Like Thomas Edison, he shaped his products to world markets hungry for their startling benefits. We see the young Eastman staying awake around the clock for 5 days straight, week after week, to get his fledgling dry photographic plate business off the ground. We see him personally mixing 450 batches of emulsion only to fail to fix a quality problem, then sailing off to Europe to find its source. Like many of the successful men whom Hill cites as examples and who had little formal education, George Eastman dropped out of school when he was 13. But according to Fisher, he had tenacity, stick-to-itiveness, and he used his wit. Eastman was obviously an accurate thinker. In fact, it seems that he employed all of Hill's principles, with the possible exception of a pleasing personality, depending on which reports you choose to believe.